listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center, and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Today we are lucky and very pleased to have with us Victoria Studden, who comes all the way from the Sloan School of Management at MIT, where she's currently a postdoctoral fellow. Victoria's done some really awesome work on a lot of different topics, ranging from statistics and computational science to law and the internet and democracy. This current work is, well, I'm going to let you just handle that, but this current work is more on the statistical computational science and the overlap of with law and internet and democracy. So, Victoria, please take it away.
Well, thanks, Aaron. So you're exactly right. So my background is in statistics. My PhD is in statistics, and then I did a master's in legal studies at Stanford Law School. And so what I've done is I've been thinking about how legal and intellectual property frameworks are impacting or possibly could help some of the computational science work that I've been involved in and used to and what we're doing as a field. So I've been thinking about the future of computational science, what is happening in information sharing, and what is happening in reproducibility of our results. So here's an outline of my talk. I was going to discuss how massive computational resources are really fundamentally changing how we're doing science and how we're doing computational science in particular. And I was going to discuss how this is creating a credibility gap in the work that we're doing as computational scientists. The massive simulations that we're doing as computational scientists are new, and we need new tools to be able to really communicate this type of work. So if you look at copyright and how this is set up for as a default on the original expression of ideas, I'll explain how this actually works against fundamental scientific norms and is an impediment to what we think we're doing as computational scientists and what perhaps we should be doing. And then I'll propose a solution to this called the reproducible research standard, and that's what I've been working on. Okay, so right now we're undergoing a transformation in how science is actually carried out. And you see this across all sorts of fields, from things like English literature, where they're doing word counts, to where you might, you know, expect this kind of thing more in climate change modeling or disease modeling. Massive computation is really changing the way we're learning about our world. Instead of using it as a tool for understanding in a traditional way, it's actually providing us with a way of doing simulations, varying parameters over those simulations to do, for example, like I said, climate change modeling and trajectories into the future and different types of prediction that we've never actually done before. So some people are saying this is creating a third branch of the scientific method. The first branch is what we're used to in mathematics, where we have a logical or just a deductive system where you would contribute to this by building on the logical structure that already exists in a deductive way. The second branch we know as empirical or inductive, where you have, for example, statistical analysis of controlled experiments. You have the entire machinery of hypothesis testing for this empirical work. The third branch doesn't seem to really fit in each of these two categories. It seems to be doing something else, and it's bringing us really beyond the ideal cases that deductive or inductive analysis can handle. So something new is going on in computational science. But what's happening is, as we're carrying out these experiments, it doesn't seem to be emphasizing control on error the way it is established in the first and second branches of the scientific method. If you look at papers that are published in computational science now, typically it's almost impossible to replicate the work that they've done. It's what they're doing, this is in my field as well, is publishing in a format that is really left over from the print journals and doesn't take advantage of communication mechanisms that we have now. And I'll get into this a little bit more. So in the scientific method, if we really want to call ourselves a third branch of the scientific method in computational science, there's elements that we really need to have in there. And one is reproducibility of our results. Traditionally, across science, we've demanded that other people are able to reproduce the results before we accept it as a contribution to our stock of knowledge. The other two branches have entire frameworks dedicated to convincing people that really, as a researcher, I've done everything I can to control for error in this analysis. This isn't as established in computational science as it is in the first two mature branches. Computational science is new. We're still learning all these things. Okay, so how we can communicate our scientific scholarship has changed. This is a less subtle change. We can see it in front of us with all the laptops that are open, and we can transmit, of course, work through the internet. So there's different ways that this is taking off. Like, for example, Archive or SSRN, scientists regularly will post their work on their own webpage that they'll host. But traditionally, and still today, what they tend to do is they communicate in the form of a journal paper or an article where they're describing the work they've done, and it's not standard to communicate the data and the code that generated these results. And the code is probably the best way to look at and understand exactly what the scientist has done, and it's going to be easier to reproduce the results if you can access their code, every step that they've taken in the data analysis process, rather than trying to read one paragraph description in a four-page conference journal or something like this. So there are changes that are coming, but right now still we're still thinking about it in terms of communicating our article and our write-up and not in terms of our entire research product, the paper, the code, the data, whatever else might go along with that, figures, interactions with your work that you might have written. There's much more now as a computational scientist to scientific scholarship than just the paper. Okay, so here's one solution to the credibility crisis that I'm dramatically calling it in this potential third branch of the scientific method. So 20 years ago, so this is a professor of geophysics at Stanford University, John Clairbout, and 20 years ago he started pioneering reproducible research in his lab. So he has a structure where the work that he does is reproducible within his lab. What he means is someone with access to his computer resources and his code, ideally someone in his research group, can go ahead and reproduce the results that other people have created. And there's a paraphrase of what this really means from David Donahoe, who is my advisor and has followed Clairbout's approach to reproducible research and also handed it down to his students as well a little bit. An article about computational science is not the scholarship itself. That's merely the advertising of the scholarship. The actual scholarship is the complete software development environment and the complete set of instructions that generated the results. So this is something you can see it applies to computational work. It's not something that necessarily applies to all scholarship, but it's something that would help us as computational scientists move towards a more rigorous application of the scientific method because we would have reproducibility here. Okay, so the way I think of reproducibility is a result is reproducible if a member of the field can independently verify this result. It doesn't mean if you're a biologist you need to, say, open the doors of your lab and let anyone in there to recreate your experiment and on your expensive machinery and so on, but most of that work is distillable into a data set and they've done analysis on it. So the way I'm thinking about reproducibility is transmission of code and data. Okay. So the original expression of ideas, if you put your, say, your code or your article out on the web, this falls under copyright by default. Copyright is designed to stop people from copying your work. If you imagine you're a poet or something like this, the idea of copyright is you don't want someone else to just take your literature or your writing and just call it their own or, you know, fold it into some of their work without checking with you first. It also gives you some control, like I just alluded to, over people who build on your work and the types of derivative works that are created. So in scientific research, this isn't how we work at all. What we want is people, like I talked about earlier, we want people to take our work and reproduce it. This means we've got a real finding. This is verification of our results. We want people to take our work and build on it and create further results and things like this without having to ask us permission and negotiate rights and things like this. This just isn't how science works. You feel, as a scientist, that you're part of a community and you're contributing your research and your results to this community, and then it's built upon. So it's at odds with copyright law that falls default on this work when you put it on the web. Okay, so there's a couple, I probably don't need to explain Larry Lessig to this audience, but a quick introduction. So Larry Lessig is Stanford and going to be Harvard law professor. He started Creative Commons. And what he wanted to do was make it easier for artists to share their work on the web under terms that they are comfortable with, not necessarily the default terms. So he created a suite of licenses allowing the author to determine the terms under which they're sharing and allowing you to use their work. So there are a lot of different things that these artists and creators can use to ascribe to their work. They can say, you can use my work with attribution. You can use my work, but not for commercial purposes. You can copy my work, but you can't create a derivative work on it. Another option you can choose is, if you create a derivative work, it must carry the same license that my original work uses. So this is called share alike, the SA. And so there's combinations of this, and the artists can choose which terms that they want to attach to their work and that they're comfortable sharing their work under. So this is similar to what's happened for years in the open source software world, where programmers and developers have written licenses or used standard licenses that are out there to also explicitly communicate the terms under which you're using their code. There's a lot of them, the BSD license, GNU GPL license, and they largely have the same breakdown as a Creative Commons license. Some of them say attribution, some of them have the share-alike component, some of them have the control of derivative works, and so you can pick and choose from these field of licenses how you want your code as a developer used. So the idea is, maybe this is a concept that we could apply to scientific work. And maybe we can use this to realign the IP framework that computational scientific work is being released under with longstanding scientific norms. So maybe there's a way to remove copyrights blocked to reproducible research, and scientists can attach a license with an attribution component to all their elements of the research compendium. For example, they could put CC attribution component on their media, which the Creative Commons licenses are intended for. They could put an attribution license on their code. And I'll also talk about data. There's something to be said about data, too, that's interesting. So here's a list of so here's the Creative Commons attribution license I'm suggesting for media, your text, and your figures. The code, modified BSD license, the MIT license, Apache 2.0, or the lesser GPL license. These are all almost the simplest licenses you can get. They essentially just have an attribution component. The reason that I'm suggesting using the attribution component licenses is because this is what we're used to as scientists. We put our work out there. We want other people, like I said, to copy it and build on it. But we do expect to be credited for the work. That's really all we ask as scientists. So this is mimicking the same behavioral norms and what we expect as scientists. OK, so what it does is it removes these reuse restrictions. Yes?
So this is my first time here. Is it OK to ask questions?
Of course. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So the problem that I see with this kind of stuff is that there's two sides to releasing the software which are problematic. One is that there's still an element of scientists having competitive advantage.
Absolutely.
So that there's no distinction that you can kind of make between I'm giving you my lab and I'm giving you my instruments or something. On the other hand, a lot of these things, like I work with the UCLA climate guys, that code is so complicated that the fact that you've put it out there, it's almost irrelevant in the sense that it's impossible for someone who doesn't work in that group to understand it. So, I mean, I'm very much on board with what you're trying to do, but it seems like somehow there's other bigger problems than the distribution itself.
Yes, no, I think you're right. So part of my motivation here is the gap between the IP framework and what we're doing as computational scientists. There is a sense in which, as you're accurately pointing out, this is a canard, right? This isn't, scientists aren't sitting there with beautifully developed code saying, I can't release this because of copyright, it sucks. But this is a starting point, and one of the things that that I'm going to talk about at the end is what this does, the reproducible research standard. One of the things it does is it changes the dialogue from my work is my paper to my work includes the code and the data, and it reframes the question of what you're actually transmitting as a scientist, which I think is an enormous step forward. So you're absolutely right that the problem isn't really, the problem with reproducibility and sharing isn't in the intellectual property framework, but this is a hook that allows university administrators or journals or funders to say, here's how, this is the product that I expect at the end. And so there's now a language to talk about these things in a broader context. So you're absolutely right that this I don't think this is the main problem. So that's the focus of my current research, is digging into what are the real problems that are actually facing scientists. And so so that's what I'm doing now, and we'll talk about the actual barriers to sharing. I mean, this is a real barrier. I don't mean to trivialize the intellectual property problem. It is a real barrier, but there's a lot more going on, like you said, that's stopping scientists from sharing their code and their data. And with regard to extremely complicated code that really only an insider would, I think that's absolutely true too. So there are climate change is a really good example, because there's essentially, I think, three of these big community models that everybody uses, and they're enormously complicated. And from what, I've never used one, but from what I understand, some of them have well-known bugs in them that no one's going to correct. And so it's very interesting, because it's an example that that reproducibility and openness, it doesn't necessarily solve all the problems. It's not a panacea. So, but it's interesting to see how it happens in action. So, so what I can say is, and other scientists that I've been talking to in my current research have said the same thing, that I don't want to become an IT guy supporting my code and putting it out there. I don't know about bringing it up to development standards. This isn't what I'm paid for. I'm not a code developer. I'm a researcher. And I think that's all fine, and I think that's acceptable. And I think we know that as scientists, what we do is, generally speaking, I mean, the more advanced models, like the climate change models, are a little different, but generally speaking, we hack together prototypes and we show that something works. And I don't see any particular problem with putting that out there, even messily. But I understand how scientists would hesitate to do that when it's not something they're rewarded for in their structure of promotions or their reputation augmentation or these other types of rewards we expect as scientists. So I think your point is dead on, and I think this is step one, and there are other steps to get to. Okay, so I wanted to do a quick discussion of data sharing. In America, your raw facts don't fall under copyright by default. but, sorry. Maybe. There's case law that puts the original selection and arrangement of these raw facts under copyright by default. So this is another small hook that I can use to say, okay, if these are under copyright by default, then there's an opportunity to attach a license here as well. So now data can be incorporated into the rubric of what it means to release your computational work on the web. Great. Thank you. So there's you're probably noticing there's a lot of blurry lines around what these things mean. I don't know exactly where original selection and arrangement stops and starts, but I think it's enough of a hook that we can go ahead and use it as a way to maybe encourage scientists, if they have more assurance of an attribution, of getting attribution for their work with data, of releasing their data. Okay. So I've been working with Science Commons, which is a Creative Commons project headed by John Wilbanks, to establish the reproducible research standard as an official brand with Creative Commons or with Scientific Commons. So the idea is, if you do release all your work, like you release your code, you release your data, and so on, you can actually tag your work as reproducible with the logo with different levels of verifiability. And we've had some interest. So the idea would be to have more influential community members in the research community adopting this. And so far, people have contacted me and said, I'd love to brand my work this way. How quickly can you get this together for us? So this is something I think that's stepping. And I think small steps is the way to go. So one thing that's really difficult about working in this area is there isn't really a definition of what you mean by science, right? Like there are so many different fields and the norms and the standards change as you even dig into subfields or even maybe down to one lab. So I think you need to be very sensitive that you can't broad brush these things, and there's a lot of adaptability and flexibility that needs to be built in for people to use this in the way that works best with their research and their mode of operating. Okay, so I alluded to some of this earlier. The reproducible research standard starts the discussion off talking about the entire research compendium, the code and the data, and everything we're doing in terms of scientific scholarship, not just your final article. It allows funders, journals, universities to talk about this, to require this maybe, and shifts the discussion away from just publishing as a paper. Another thing that's important is So some scientists are aware of this. As I've been doing my current research and talking to scientists, some of them put licensing on their data or on their code. They're not lawyers, and it's not clear that they necessarily should be acting like a lawyer. I mean, they don't need to read hundreds of licenses and trying to discern which is best for their work. So they're putting licenses on there that can create conflicts in the future. So I talked about the share-alike standard earlier, and share-alike says, if you're going to build on this work, the work you create all falls under this license. So you can imagine if one scientist puts their work out with a share-alike component on one license and another one puts their work out with another license that also has a share-alike component, now you can't mix these two works because they're both telling you that that license rigidly needs to be applied to the work that you're producing. So you end up with problems. So I think this is another real problem that we're facing as scientists in discussing this licensing issue early before a lot of the work falls under different types of licenses that you can't necessarily mix, and you get problems putting two pieces of code together, for example, that you shouldn't necessarily get. So there is an academic fair use component in copyright, and some people have asked me, well, doesn't just all of this fall under fair use? Can't you just make this argument? And I think that's true. I think you can make the argument. The question is, again, where is the boundary? So there isn't really clarity about where fair use stops and where copyright starts in the academic fair use exception. So it might be better to just be clear about exactly what the rights are and put your work out there with the attribution component and just be clear that this is open for copying and this is open for reproducibility and building on. That also would get around any potential chilling effect in sharing work, that if a scientist isn't really sure about what you can use legitimately under fair use, maybe they just wouldn't really use your work at all. So it might be better just to be clear and explicit about it. Of course, what I want to do is facilitate research and sharing and building upon other people's work. And the IP framework, which is diametrically opposed right now to what our norms are as scientists, should somehow be realigned. And so this is one step in starting the discussion. Okay, so it's extremely broad brush, what I've been talking about. It's not clear that this is necessarily applicable in all situations. You don't have the ability to always share your data. Sometimes there are privacy concerns you just can't do anything about, for example. So this would be taken care of in the levels, like when you brand your work as reproducible, you would be able to say it's semi-verifiable or something like this. If you put the code out and people could try it on their own similar data sets, instead of being fully verified, for example. Attribution is a problem I'm also working on now. academic citation isn't the same thing as legal attribution. So all the way through the talk, I've been talking about legal attribution. Again, what we do as scientists is academic citation. So I don't want to impose a structure on scientists if they want to use this standard where they become an administrator keeping track of details of who's contributed what to the work and maintaining an attribution log or something like this. It needs to be as easy as possible for scientists to use this standard and as congruent with their existing work habits as possible. So that's something I'm working on. There's a couple of little hooks. The CC BY license says it has wording in its terms that says that you can do attribution in a way that's reasonable to the medium, is what they say. And I think it's clear that what they're talking about is there are many different works of art that the license could be attached to, like, for example, like sculpture or film or literature, and citation and attribution in that sense should be reasonable. Like it maybe it's done a certain way in film that's different to how you might do it in literature, and so this is fine under the license. So maybe I can stretch that and say attribution's okay since this is scientific work if we do it in a typical scientific citation way. So there are things I'm working on there with attribution. I think it's also an opportunity to push further into machine readability of attribution, because we're getting into situations now where data sets are being built, say genome data sets, where 40,000 PhDs are doing just little tiny bits on it, and you do end up with these complicated attribution scenarios that are new. So this is something I don't want to freeze in the moment how attribution has to be done, because collaboration is changing and how we're going to attribute as scientists is changing. Another problem with this is because copyright's a default, there's a need for the scientist to actually do something here. That's not, you know, this isn't something they necessarily signed up for as a scientist. Another huge problem is how do you share your data or your code? It's one thing if you, like you were saying earlier, to put code out there that's a mess that no one really can reasonably use. I mean, isn't that satisfying? I mean, you've shared your code, but is it really satisfying the reproducible research standard? So this is an argument for not mandating this. I think it would be pretty easy to comply with this in a superficial way and really not have the compliance and the reproducibility there behind, even though it might look reproducible. So platforms for data sharing and code verification, this is something interesting, and I think this might be something that comes from the journals. And peer review might be a lot easier if you can click a few buttons or reproduce someone's results quickly through using their code. So there might be an incentive for journals to move forward and do something like this and support this effort. So that's also what I was talking about in openness standards. Like, what does it mean to have your code acceptable for use in the community? Again, that probably comes down to a question of community norms and what's useful. So I'm talking as if scientists never do this, but some scientists do this successfully and put their work out there in a reproducible way. Clairbout's not the only one. So there are examples out there of people doing it. And many of them would tell you that they garner more citation from doing this and sharing their work and having their data out there and used. And there's seems to be a serendipitous effect of data not being used in ways in which the original revealer never imagined. So you can benefit science in ways that you didn't think of when you share your work, and also, of course, garner your citations and augment your reputation from doing that. Okay, so that was. So this is one of the reasons that's a problem with the reproducible research standard, is that especially younger faculty members are under a lot of pressure for tenure, and it's not so clear that they're going to want to spend time doing anything that doesn't channel them into that tenure argument. Okay, so I have a draft on my webpage as a paper that's coming out, I think, next month, April. It will be published.
Where?
It's the International Journal of Communication Policy, I think. Okay, well, thank you. And I'm, of course, happy to take questions.
Yeah. I had one, actually, that I did want to ask you, which was, I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, so I think you made a good case about how to implement this, but I wanted to go back to a really, like, sort of play devil's advocate on sort of a background question here in some ways, which is, you know, so the case for reproducibility and for meeting standards of reproducibility here, beyond, you know, some lovely ideals of scientific methods and things like that, I mean, is your sense that, because I could see that there's a case that would come out of sort of a research on innovation and research on large scale problem solving that would sort of say, mm-hmm. oh, this needs to be available because that's the best way to create this serendipitous effect.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, though, in your sense of talking to other scientists and stuff, sort of does the, of those two kinds of arguments, I mean, what gets traction? Is one more compelling than the other in your sense of talking with people who are doing this work? That, you know, appealing to the scientific
yeah.
method is the way to go, and that sort of pushes them, or is it that, you know, you can say, look, here's this other research that proves that this is the best way to build
right.
knowledge.
Right, right.
You should be doing this.
I think this is the heart of the issue, and this is a really tough problem. And I think the second is probably right, that it's economic man out there, or whatever you want to call them, and they're worried about you know, their immediate incentives rather than these more lofty goals. So I think that's where you're going, and I think you're absolutely right on that one. Yeah, no, I think you're right. So my sense is that this isn't something probably that's going to bubble up organically. I thought when I first started researching this that it might be, because you do get to be a better scientist, and there is a lot of evidence that you do, the more open you are with your work, the more citations and the more publicity you get, and scientists want this. So I think this is why you're starting to get scientists who are revealing and putting their work out there. And scientists I've been talking to, maybe some of them don't reveal anything, and some it's like 20%, 50%. So it's out there, and they are starting to do it, and it's important to them. But again, it's like that McDonald's cartoon. If they're not being rewarded for this, it's kind of a waste of time, right? I mean, you can say, yeah, but I was a really great scientist. Look, you can verify all my results. Yeah, but you only produced 2 papers, so we're not promoting you. It's just that if that's the reality right now, I mean, I completely sympathize with scientists who can't spend the time documenting their code a little bit or putting it out there. So this is something where what I'm hoping to do is follow some of the work that's been done in open access, where there's a more open discussion with faculty members and researchers about norms and about what they're doing and what the requirements are in their research and what they're comfortable with. I think that's the way to go, and do it through a more uniform, steps forward, I think, is really the way to go. And maybe through, people have suggested that the way to do it is through journals. And one idea is creating a reproducible piggyback journal on prestigious journals that's just the reproducible research version of it. And this is one way to introduce reproducibility, because if you start a journal that no one's ever heard of and it's reproducible and you're putting extra work into publishing there, it's not clear why you would publish there as opposed to the prestigious journal where you were accepted, right? But if you can keep some of that prestige, then maybe that's one way to move forward and introduce reproducibility. Another one is through standards in departments. And it looks like there's some evidence that reproducibility can be rewarded in some areas, but it's small. So, but that seems like, I take your point.
I guess what it points towards is the fact that, because there are these norms of sharing. I mean, if I, you know,
email so-and-so
and say, hey, I'm interested in doing something that builds on this paper you did 5 years ago, do you still have the code for that? Odds are so-and-so will send it to me unless they're a real turd or something. So the norms are not enough.
I think you have a better chance of getting the data than the code, I think.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So one of the things that's interesting about this, too, is reproducibility. It doesn't just help you be a good community member. It helps you reproduce your own work. Like, we all know when we've worked with code that a month goes by and you look at it again and you have no idea what you were doing or what you were thinking and so on. And so this is a way to also, like, if you... if you know your work is, this is one of the things I learned as a PhD student, if you know your work and all your code's going to be open from the beginning when you start, you, I think you just do better science as you go through. Yeah, Esther.
So I totally agree with a lot of what you said, including that people should learn to do work that's reproducible, partly because you yourself forget what you did a month ago, but not to mention 2 years ago. But I was thinking as I was listening to this, so fields that mix, that have a mix of quantitative and qualitative work, this is interesting because, again, if you don't incentivize this in some really major way, then people in a field who do quantitative versus their qualitative colleagues are at a, almost as a disadvantage, right? Because it's not, I mean, on the one hand, you could argue, yeah, you should also share qualitative work, but that's going to be, you know, then the whole IRB and confidentiality and all those things become much more complicated. And then what is it, like half the field is supposed to be sharing and then the other half doesn't have to, and then they don't have to be dealing with the fact that, you know, they just spent twice as much time on a project because they didn't have to share, or so it just adds to the complexity of how do you build in the incentives for sharing.
This is a great point. And this presentation is super broad brush. And as you dig into each field, you're going to see all these things come out. I don't see a way around. So clearly, when I think in 2 slides, I talked about sharing data, right? And of course, there's many reasons data can't be shared, or it's more complicated, or, you know, if you've done a survey on people, it's not clear that you can even scrub the data in such a way that you can actually release it. So it's So it is a complicated and tricky, and I don't think you want to disadvantage quantitative people as opposed to people who are doing the more qualitative work. On the other hand, I believe there's evidence that as a quantitative researcher, sharing does benefit you in terms of citations and so on. So so there's some research that supports this. But I think the norms within each particular field, and it's always delicate like this, and so there are always these situations that are going to crop up, and I think you need to be careful about not imposing a standard on people that does disproportionately affect quantitative researchers in a negative way. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
I appreciate sort of where you're coming from and sort of saying, well, we have to have kind of a intellectual framework and, I don't know, legal or whatever framework for this. But, well, you know, I'm a technologist, so for me, you know, the mechanism comes first and, you know, then then the policy on top of that. And it seems to me that you need some kind of, you need a kind of meta reproducibility, that is, which, you know, you perhaps need some kind of standardized cloud computing environment, right? Like, I do my research in a, you know, certain environment, and I can upload a VMware image into the cloud, and, you know, there's a build process for it, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Until you have that, right, then you're in this kind of weird limbo of, I mean, you use the term branding, and, right, it kind of isn't much beyond the branding, and there's this huge transition point where it goes from being a brand to being something that I can really usefully do.
There's a couple of things. I think you're exactly right about we need more tools. This is another thing scientists that I've been talking to, more tools for enabling sharing and making it easier and more uniform, particularly with data. But what you're talking about with code, I think you're exactly right. And I've talked to computer scientists, and people seem to be interested in the problem. So one of the things that's nice about this is there's a lot of different fields coming together, and I think there's an enormous role for computer scientists here in enabling a lot of this work.
I guess I wanted to say a combination of virtualization and cloud computing that are both sort of relatively new, I think offers a lot more promise than there was 10 years ago, say.
No, I think that's right. And I think that, but the computer scientists that I've talked to, one of the things they're concerned about, the ones who are concerned about reproducibility and studying this, is it's also a question of training. Like, I think there are people doing computational work who just sort of hack together a few things in Excel or whatnot. And it's not clear, no, and I think that's perfectly normal. And it's not clear that this is not a path to reproducibility unless they're going to record click streams or something like this. I mean, so something has to change. And I think asking a scientist who's done it this way for a number of years to suddenly jump into cloud computing, and so it's going to be tough, right? And so one of the things that that's important is training and so on. And probably realistically, it needs to start with the PhD students now and move forward that way. But I think that you're right in pointing out that having tools is exceptionally important, and then whether or not people use these tools is the other side of the question. So they're both really important. But I'm encouraged because people do seem to be moving in this direction, and the fields are moving towards reproducibility, just like anecdotally from what I see out there. And from what I've looked at in journal publishing, we're just moving towards more computational work. And so I feel like these are problems that are, in some sense, enormous and huge, but also that we can work around, like you're suggesting. Yeah.
On that question, if you're building the system, it helps to know the framework on which you're going to put it. They sort of go together because some of the restrictions or non-restrictions that fit with the licenses and stuff, you want to sort of build that in there. And then you need to model. You have to have people using it who model how you use that around that stuff, and then people follow the model. So the new people coming in don't know any better because they're following the model of their mentors.
So this actually, I meant to say this in response to your previous question, too. So one of the things that we haven't completely hammered out in the reproducible research standard is this idea of tagging it as verifiable or verified. And so one of the ideas that we had in doing this, and this was suggested by a grad student at Berkeley, actually, is when you first put your work up there, then it's verifiable, assuming you've got the code and the data and you think people should be able to do it. But then it can switch to verified when another community member has actually reproduced your results. So this is sort of what you're talking about, in that now there's an incentive built in for me as someone who's sharing to actually have someone use and reproduce my results. So there's some community strengthening going on.
In the system, like just the idea that when you commit something to a version control thing, it asks you for a short form of explaining what it was, which helps.
Right.
Everything in your case, the flag saying was verified, making it easy to verify it, that it's always flagged in front of you, that it's not verified.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that can affect
quite how
a bit,
you
whether you follow it or not.
Yep.
So when you're building the tools, you want to know what you're building it for, too. I mean, it goes, there's a chicken and an egg.
That yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, and it also brings up the question of the different skill levels and the different familiarity with these tools in a variety of different fields. Like I've seen people doing work, say, in word counts in Shakespeare, and they're English literature professors and so on. And so it's not so clear they're going to jump in. And one of the things that's interesting is I think biology is one of the fields that seems to be on the forefront of sharing. They have open wetware, and they have different ways of sharing their data. And also, I wouldn't necessarily put them in the bin of the most intensively computational people. Like some of them use tools that they don't seem to have the formal training in computer science, and they use tools that maybe aren't ideally optimized for sharing. And so you end up with I don't know whether it's a cultural issue, but you definitely end up with situations where I think some fields would be more readily eager to adopt something like this than others. Yeah.
Another thought is that, I don't know, again, maybe this is field specific, but I don't think it's obvious in all fields how you actually cite things like data sources per se, and what credit that really gives the originator of the data. So for example, I share survey instruments with people all the time, and I've had a couple of pieces where I talk about them and then I say, well, if you use it, could you at least maybe cite this? But the fact is that I would say probably 90% of the time, I end up getting absolutely no credit for that. And, you know, okay, big deal, I can deal, but still, it would be nice to get some, because you do put a lot of work into this. And
no, I absolutely agree. So that's really interesting on a number of levels. So this is where I said attribution is still something of an open problem. So some of the ideas that I've discussed with Science Commons is maybe scientists would be more comfortable turning their sort of copyrights over to a central body, like an NSF type body or something like this, that does handles the attribution. So for example, you would have a situation when you're sharing and then compliance is dictated. Essentially this body would put a list of best practices by field and you follow it as best you can, because it is really different in different fields how you would cite and the importance of data or whatnot. And again, this is something where we talk about legal attribution, but its manifest is different and the meaning is different in different fields. So maybe if some central body had a list of best practices and you tried your best to comply, this is good enough. And then it's written down what you're supposed to do. And so you move to a more transparent system, maybe this way. So that's one idea that we've been thinking of. And then scientists maybe don't have to worry so much about management of this attribution issue. But other people, when I've been talking to them, have raised this. I mean, one guy was just like, attribution's completely broken in my field. I've been credited for things I didn't do. And I don't get credit for the important things I do. And so on. And this is an established emeritus professor, like an icon in the field. And so that's something that I'm thinking about now, that I haven't thought about it enough to know the roots of the problem or what's going on, whether it's communication or mentorship or just lack of clarity about norms or what, but it's something I'm thinking about, and maybe it's something we can spotlight a little bit, because one of the scientific norms is we're supposed to credit when you do a lot of work, and that's standard and accepted. Yeah. Yeah.
With the tools to make it easier to automatically do it, watermarks, this has been an issue for the last thousands of years. That's why if you look at old poems from way back, you'll find the name of the person in the first letter of each of the stanzas or something like that. Watermarks are an old thing. How to do that in the data without compromising the data, but to make it so that it's without thinking, you do it. But you also need the back. You want to make it not just they attribute you. You want to know that you're being attributed,
right?
Because if you want to get tenure, you want to know how many references you have.
Right.
So that may go hand in hand with watermarks of some sort. We're searching. This is a Google issue too.
Yes.
Google and companies like that too can be helpful.
This is also what you were saying earlier about version control and so on. We can track exactly who's doing what changes and so on. I think it's up to the field to know or to determine what level of attribution they're really comfortable with and whether they need that level of granularity or whatnot. So I think there is another layer there. But I think that's right. I think it comes from the tools, and if we have cleverly designed tools for this kind of thing,
So I mean, a place where the kind of legal issues of the Creative Commons and so on collides with this is so like your example of the researcher with the Excel spreadsheet, right? For that really to be reproducible, like 50 years from now, we need to package up Windows and Excel,
right,
and a whole stack of
right,
copyrighted, patent, whatever, IP protected stuff. So do you have any thoughts about how to deal with that?
Yeah, that's the archiving question, and that's an enormous problem. So I don't have any great answers for this, and again, I'm hoping that this is, I do hope that people who are using Excel can recognize this isn't reproducible work that they're doing in the strict sense that I'm talking about. And maybe there are other tools they can shift to that can remember their commands and so on and their workflow a little more easily. So that I think is straightforward, that if you're interested in reproducibility, you just can't use Excel for, not because it's proprietary, but just because it can't really track exactly what you're doing and who knows what modifications you've made to the data set now and so on.
So that
is the archiving issue, and that's another huge one. Like that, and Clairbout talks about this too. So I talked to other geophysicists in his department and why they don't behave in the same way as Clairbout does, and he basically will give you a make file, and then you go ahead and you do everything right from the beginning and reproduce his figures. And they said, yeah, but it's a lot of maintenance, right? So, there's a new version of LaTeX comes out, and now all of a sudden the images that you've created, they're broken, and you have to go back in there. So he has people who are just working on maintaining this, and it's this is something that some researchers just don't feel that they're equipped for. Yeah, it's all there. Yeah, so old textbooks he's written and so on.
So, like, I can go to his old work and he's maintaining that it works with, like, version 2.7 of LaTeX?
I mean, I haven't rerun everything of his, but that's my understanding, yeah. Yeah, and so, so he'll, like, yeah, so, but that's what happens is you have C or Fortran changes a little bit, and then you have to look back. And so it becomes a really hairy issue, and that's not even getting to the obsolescence issue where 20 years from now, if we want to run it, you know, it's not even clear that that's going to be possible. But so the archiving, I think it's a longer term issue. I think the reproducibility is probably important in the near term. I mean, that's one way around it a little bit, but it doesn't address the issue strictly like it should be. But so it's a little bit of a cop out to say yes, we need more tools, but I mean, clearly we do. So that, but I mean, talking to people, this is something I think computer scientists are working on. It's not an issue that we need to build from the ground up.
Well, there's the tools part, but there's also the law part, right, of like going to Microsoft and saying, hey, give us some sort of exemption so that we can archive this stuff and reuse it 50 years, you know, or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how they would feel about that. I do know that I've come under some criticism because my PhD work, which I call reproducible, is done in MATLAB. And so people say, well, if you want to be strict about it, why are you using proprietary software and making it so I can't reproduce your work unless I pay you whatever $1,000 license and so on. I think it's a great question that, it's an open issue. Yeah.
Well, I get it out, as usually, and it's legal, as usually. You mentioned that one of the main sort of barriers is law, right? Meaning that you probably want to or suggest that it should be improved or fixed, right? And that the area which needs fixation is copyright, right? Mm. Essentially, because it gives you the protection by default, right? Mm. I'm not sure if I agree with it, because you've always, ever since the copyright was invented, not that long time ago, you as an author, you've always had the right to do with your work whatever you want. What copyright, what Creative Commons does is just to standardize the options that you may have and make it more sort of easier. Mm-hmm. I also see a problem here, but it's not really within the copyright, but it's rather the question of antitrust. This is actually what the European Commission has been training against Microsoft in this interoperability cases and issues. To what extent you are protected by intellectual property when you exploit the property commercially, first, second, when your position on the market is so strong that you dictate the rules, right? So you haven't mentioned the antitrust. To me, it's the if there is a barrier there, it's not copyright, it's antitrust. Do you agree?
Here's my perspective. So my perspective is my experience working as a PhD student and seeing how academics work, and thinking that they can put scripts and data and so on out there. I haven't seen much awareness of what we're doing on the part of Microsoft or on the part of these sort of big industrial leaders, or really much concern. So I don't know if that will change and the antitrust issues would become a larger issue. But I see copyright as an important issue because it affects right now who can copy and build on my work if I stick it on the web right now. So I see it as an immediate issue, unless I'm misunderstanding, you know, what you're saying.
How you want to improve it then? Do you see a scope for improving policy making, improving copyrights?
Yeah.
I've missed it.
So I agree with this. So that's the first part of your question, where we have always been able to contract around copyright. So copyright is there as a default, but if I email you and say, can I blatantly copy your work, and you say yes, well, great, you know, there's no problem. So where I'm coming from is, especially computational scientists, they're not well-versed in these legal issues and might not be. Like, most of them don't realize that copyright is actually falling on their work. So this framework is a way of maybe addressing the legal issues for them, in a sense, and making it easier or something that they don't need to actually wade through intellectually, and there's no reason why they should, and it's probably not even interesting for them.
So it's not law, which is a barrier, but unawareness of law, right?
I think that's true, and I think the fact that they would need to take activity like the selection of licenses I was talking about to make it so that there isn't this one-on-one negotiation all the time, which they might not even do because they're not aware of copyright. So, but this also begs the question that he raised, which is, well, how much is of an issue is this copyright anyway? I mean, we don't see academics suing each other for copyright infringement. It's just really not, in real practice, it's really not that much of an issue. But it could become an issue. And one thing I haven't talked about here is patents, too, and what's happening. This tends to be more in biochemistry, but there's some patenting going on in software algorithms and CS and things like this. And that is something that I think there's another issue there. It's smaller, I think, than what's happening with copyright as a block to sharing, but there's a whole other issue there, too. So I think there's really three legal issues to address. Yeah.
I was thinking about the policy implications of some of the things that you suggested, which I believe is very cool. And obviously, funding institutions could have an important role here because, you know, money is power. If they give the money to the scientists, they could at least suggest, you know, make sure that your results are open. They do that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was going to ask you, who does that, by the way? Like, NSF does that?
Yeah, NSF does do that. And they say that you need to share all your, because you're taking public money, your results are public, and the public's paid for it, and they have a right to see what you're doing, and you're supposed to share it all. I mean, I quote the exact text in my in the paper that I referred to. My understanding on why this isn't enforced is because it's not clear what that means, right? Like, what does it mean to have you done this appropriately here? So they don't have a structure for really enforcing this. So one hope I have is maybe this work can set them down a path where they're thinking more about a structure to do this. So this is, it's just a new policy area where I think getting the discussion going, and I think you're right. So if funders with the money can actually create a clear framework, well, your code needs to be released under this, and this is how your media gets released, and the data this, then that can maybe be enforceable. Whereas just saying, I think the wording is something like it needs to be open to the public at no incremental cost or something like this. But it's, I don't know, does that mean posting it on the web, or what does it mean? So they don't act on it. They don't really enforce it. But it's in there. The language is in there.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me that what would be really nice to go off of here would be if someone had done, if there was some nice research that was done looking at how to change standards of academic practice, or, you know, historical examples of how academic norms or, community norms like this get moved around. Because there, it seems like you're pursuing sort of several different strategies where, you know, that vary between looking to work with central organizations that can enforce these things through grant-making processes, through building tool sets, to just sort of spreading the word that, hey, this is a good thing that gets you better citations,
right.
So individual incentives.
That's right.
It's not totally, it doesn't seem like it's totally clear what, you know, which of those sort of, you know, things is going to actually push something, get a ball rolling downhill fast enough.
Yeah, I would say it's probably the higher level stuff that's going to get the ball rolling rather than the individual incentive stuff. But, and I think, I think the place to start is this grassroots awareness of what's happening and whether we can be doing a better job of sharing our work as scientists. But it's true. It's a fairly new issue. So there are a lot of different angles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The NSF angle, I mean, it's really tricky if you start thinking about the very specifics, right? Like, what would be, how could they enforce it? I mean, what would it be? Well, if you haven't done X, you are not eligible for future funding.
Right.
That's complicated because,
right.
You know, a lot of NSF grants are for like 5 years.
Right.
So what is that? Like, extension, you know, the time of your grant plus a couple of years because you need time to put it up. And
right.
So it's just, and then, you know, what if someone doesn't do it?
Right.
I mean, who do, you know, like, mm-hmm. where? How do you express grievance in terms of
mm-hmm.
if you contact someone, I'd like your data, and they never respond? There's absolutely
do
no
you
way
sue?
To.
I mean,
no one's
going
to do that.
Right.
And
no, I think you're absolutely right. Yeah, that's hairy. I think that's why they've stepped away from it.
Database where you report that somebody didn't contact you back and wasn't willing to share, and then
or even
refers
within
your
journals. Yeah.
And I mean, there are actually, there are journals that require you to say, you know, I'm willing to, in order to publish in the journal, you have to sign and say, I'm willing to share the data with, but again, even there, there's nothing about within what time frame, in what format, how clear should your data be.
And what happens
sharing.
If you don't do it, which
no, exactly,
them don't.
That's exactly it. Right. Like, someone could contact me and what if I never
you're
respond,
traveling,
right?
Yeah, right, and the email gets lost or whatever, yeah.
Yeah.
But this is also, so some fields have been doing work on this, like setting standards for, well, if we fund this, you need to release your data in 6 months or 2 years or whatnot. And there's big negotiations within the community about what's considered fair. With data collection, there does seem to be a sense of possessiveness about it. If the more work you put in, the more time people are kind of willing to give you to hang on to it, to milk it for more publications. Or whatnot. Most of what I've been talking about is post-publication stuff. So, yeah.
Sorry. Have you had? Have you had any? You referred several times to the sort of, you know, tenure and promotion, reputational thing, and the high value on, you know, that we all place on independence, and you know, and you know, being the person that got something started, and all the rest of that, which
right.
tends to bias everyone against. Sharing credit too generously. So have you talked to anybody who, like, you know, is responsible for, you know, academic promotion process and pointed out the extent to which that set of imperatives actually works against the progress of science?
Yeah. So I, not formally, but informally, I have talked to a few. And most of them are like, a great idea. And this is actually a problem. This is a problem in my research. Yeah, no, right.
It's a form of
but no, this is actually a deep problem in my research now, surveying and talking to scientists, is the ones who are kind of in favor of it are the ones who are going to talk to you in the open, and the ones who don't really want anything to do with it, it's harder to get them to tell you why. And so that's a problem. But I think Gary King had a recommendation that if tenure committees just had you know, another field for reproducibility, it would just change everything. And so I think people are thinking about it out there. But in, I mean, I haven't dug into it, and I can take guesses on what's going on. Like, it's, you know, you sort of grow up with a certain system, and when and on whom do you change it and make the requirements different? And so there, I think, I don't know, it has to be well thought through. So, but that's a great suggestion, talking to the people more, mm-hmm. the promotion people.
Maybe one more question?
Well, then, at the risk of complicating an already hopelessly complicated thing, so I mean,
as
I said before, coming here, I work at IBM Research, and so, you know, all of this discussion is kind of oriented around the academic research and academic rewards and promotion and so on. A problem that I have is that lots of the stuff that I do is done in the context of software systems that IBM owns and that I can't open source. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, that means that in a lot of cases, I'm actually doing much higher quality studies than my colleagues at universities who are basically working with software systems that are kind of toy approximations of the one that I've used. So, you know, there's... and nevertheless, I'm playing in that same sort of ecosystem with them. And, you know, as a scientist, I agree that, you know, openness is good. But on the other hand, as a realist working in that kind of environment, well, I can't always do that. So,
yeah.
I know.
Yeah, I think there is some straitjacketing that happens in industrial research. The only thing I can... Yeah. Well, I mean, I did a summer internship at IBM, and I remember the patent-driven model well. what I can say is that so the framing that I have for my work, it does come from this academic perspective, and that's really what I'm basing it on, is that we have this maybe a moral imperative to be open with our work and so on. It just doesn't exist for people who are in a proprietary setting. So you have a different set of rules on your game. So I would say that maybe, I mean, IBM did just release a ton of their patent IPs, right, and completely open it and give license for people to be using a significant amount of their patents. And so maybe there's something happening where they're realizing openness might be a way to go within the firm and productive for them rather than being in a more proprietary setting. I don't think they're probably ever going to release, you know, the core code base or whatnot. But maybe, I mean, if you are interacting heavily in the same research space with academics, maybe there is some gain to sharing. I don't know. So, I mean, that's something that I think it's interesting in the proprietary context. Can I take one more?
Okay. This is separate, but it's related. Okay. Doc Searles wasn't here. He has told me to come today.
Okay.
I'm Dan Bricklin, and I'll tell you who and what later. But I'm running a panel, well, it's an open discussion tomorrow morning, which is titled Designing IT in the Age of Obama. Okay. And where does that come from? Well, it comes from Obama in his inaugural speech talked about inclusiveness, growth, and person, and about responsibility to greater than the company or the, you know, yourself.
Right.
He also then the next day had a directive that talked about transparency.
Participation and cooperation.
Participation and cooperation. Those were the three areas that are official. We're supposed to do that. In light of Creative Commons, etc. Okay. What that brings up is the following questions. You know, from a structural viewpoint, what things do we want to do now easily and expensively, like the stuff you're talking about, that used to be way too hard and prohibitively expensive, and what new legal frameworks do we need to create and adopt widely to make this so you don't have to pioneer each time to make it do it? And there are just all sorts of questions related to that, which may come back to this, because if the overall view of society is to have openness, sharing, participation, and collaboration, that that's the way we're supposed to work. If you get in that mindset, this comes through pretty easily.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm here to try to get people to come. You should talk to me about how you can get in for free, but Doc is going to be there. We have somebody from Microsoft who works with the government. We have a senior person at Sun and a senior person at Black Duck, who used to be at Red Hat, talking about it, but I want it to be an open discussion. It will be podcast. I will try. I will be podcasting and leading it at the same time. It will not be, but it won't be broadcast live.
Yeah, so...
If you go to Google and search on Obama Clutrain Manifesto, it comes up number 4.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I can say that, at least from my perspective with this work, I'm thrilled at the sort of emphasis on transparency and openness at the higher levels. And maybe there is some trickle down. I mean, I don't know, but to... Yeah.
People are now they're scrambling to figure out how to do this stuff and all these tools. Yeah. And government has the problem of sovereignty, which gets into the long-term reproducibility stuff. The tools, you can't send something out as a government direct, you know, publication that isn't going to be readable 200 years from now.
Right, right.
So there are all sorts of issues that this brings up, which are going to be really important and interesting. Even though he had that, but it was one of the first things he did as president. So.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Can I just say as a reaction to the tools focus, which is sort of the technology focus.
Yeah.
So while it's great to have more tools, we can't forget the human component. And if this is to get out broadly to different fields, tools are not going to be enough. So it's my usual spiel, right? Like, it's a necessary step, but it's not going to be sufficient.
Mm-hmm. No, that's absolutely true.
It's helpful.
That's part of what you want to have done.
It's another helpful component.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Yeah, this is great.